Welcome back to the Our Voices podcast. I'm Freddie Stewart. Kashama Sawant is a socialist politician and economist who serves on the Seattle City Council. She is also a member of the organisation Socialist Alternative, who helped empower her run for office in 2013. Since this election, Sawant has been one of the most vocal voices on the American left. Her term in office has been marked by championing increases in the state minimum wage and calling for higher taxes on multinational corporations. In 2018, Sawant was one of only two dissenting voices on the City Council, voting in favour of a Seattle head tax, which would have seen Amazon pay $11 million annually in order to fund public housing and homelessness services in the local area. In response, Amazon spent an unprecedented $1.5 million in a bid to defeat her run for re-election in 2019. Having defied these attempts, Sawant hit the headlines once again a couple of weeks ago when she opened the doors of the Seattle City Hall to marching Black Lives Matter protesters. She took the mic and called once again for a tax on Amazon and for defunding the Seattle police. This interview we did with Kashama predates that event and focuses predominantly on her work in Seattle and how the city is responding to the joint crises of homelessness and healthcare during the COVID-19 pandemic. She began by outlining the extent of the housing crisis in Seattle and how 500,000 people are now homeless across the United States.
The United States, as we know, is the richest country in the history of humanity, and I'm sitting here in the core of the city of Seattle, which is one of the wealthiest cities in the world. And we have a situation in Seattle, which is a very important illustration of the fundamental way in which capitalism functions, which is in a fundamentally dysfunctional way, so to say, where it's a very wealthy city. We have more billionaires and millionaires and overall wealthy people in the city than the city had, say, 10 years ago or even 6 years ago. And at the same time, we have an unprecedented housing affordability crisis in this city. And one of the most visible and stark manifestations of this housing affordability crisis is the historically high numbers of homeless community members in our city and also in the region. But I don't want to make any kind of Seattle exceptionalism argument on this, because in reality, what we're seeing is throughout the United States and actually all across North America, when you include Canada and Mexico, we see metropolitan areas facing a deep housing crisis as they haven't experienced in living memory and perhaps ever. It sort of shows what has happened with neoliberalism, the neoliberal period under capitalism, and the fact that capitalism as a system is in such decline that it is not even able to provide the semblance of support structure that it was able to provide given, you know, the victories that were won by the militant labor movements around the world in the 40s through the 70s. And so you're seeing this manifest not only in Seattle, not only in North America, but around the world. And, you know, needless to say, the tragedy and travesty of the Grenfell fire and disaster, you know, really is an example of how, while there is unimaginable wealth, trillions of dollars in the hands of a few, on the other hand, the hundreds of millions, in fact, billions, are struggling for basic needs like housing. And you see that coming up in all over the world with increased numbers of homelessness, even in cities like Dublin that hadn't seen homelessness really before. You're seeing this manifest everywhere. And of course, it's in a much worse situation when you consider the neo-colonial part of the world.
In Seattle, you've proposed a head tax and other progressive taxes to fund public housing at all. I was wondering if you can expand on your efforts within the Seattle City Council to go after some of the highest grossing corporations like Amazon to fund more public housing.
The city of Seattle and the state of Washington as a whole has the nation's most regressive tax system. And so what you see is the most working class, the most poor, the poorest, most vulnerable households paying double-digit tax rates, especially when you look at all the taxes that are levied on working-class people, sales tax. And if you're a middle-class homeowner or a working-class homeowner, you pay property taxes. And so all the regressive tax mechanisms are in place, but virtually none of the progressive tax mechanisms are in place. So in other words, at the state level, there is no tax on wealthy income households or wealth or no tax on wealthy estates. There is no tax on corporations at all. So in fact, you have this tremendously unjust situation where not only do the wealthiest corporations like Boeing, Microsoft, or Amazon pay virtually no taxes at the state level. They pay zero taxes at the federal level. That much is clear now. But when you add up all the subsidies that they get from a corporate-dominated state legislature and have a net tax rate for them, they actually sometimes end up having a negative net tax rate, meaning they're getting more back from the working class taxpayers than they are putting into the system. So it's in that grossly unequal situation that our movement, as you correctly said, led in part by our socialist city council office and by Socialist Alternative, my political organization, we've been fighting for the last 2-3 years for the Amazon tax, which is a tax on the largest corporations of the city, so that we can provide much needed funds for not only for addressing the homelessness crisis, but really to provide social housing. And social housing is an important concept which has already been seen through the victories of the militant labor movements in the past. In England, you have council housing, which is of course being gutted and is under constant attack, not only from the Tories, but also from the Blairite Labour Party that we have now in the UK. We have social housing in Vienna, which is also being gutted and under attack. But that's the concept we're talking about, where we recognize that Seattle has been the construction crane capital of the country 4 years running. In other words, construction is booming. You can't walk a few blocks without running into those giant cranes. But at the same time, housing has become less affordable and rents have skyrocketed, which in other words shows you how the capitalist for-profit market system does not build for affordability. It builds to maximize profits at the top. So we need an alternative to the for-profit market in the first place. That's why we want to, we have put forward a proposal to raise $300 million every year by taxing just the largest 3% of corporations. So, 97% of the small and medium-sized businesses, none of them is going to pay. Nonprofits will not be paying. Government employers will not be paying. But only the wealthiest corporations. In other words, it's the wealthiest people that will be paying, so that we can raise $300 million per year, so that we can address seriously the homelessness crisis, start building green-built, union-built social housing. And also, some of those funds will be reserved for the Green New Deal.
In terms of organizing to help reverse this trend, as you said, of neoliberal capitalism to privatize housing for profit, I wondered if you could speak to the role of social movements. Obviously, things like the Homes Guarantee have become particularly formative in recent years, and the relationship of those movements with this new wave of progressive politicians.
I think that's a very, very important point to consider, because really, if you don't analyze the role of social movements, you have nothing, because throughout history we have seen, and not just recent history, but history as far back as it can go, since the beginning of class society, that without collective organizing and militancy in social movements, we really don't see progressive change. So all the progressive change that we have seen so far, whether you talk about the French Revolution, or the American Civil War, or the civil rights movement in the United States, you see a common thread running through all of those periods, which is that whatever gains have been won to make the lives better of the majority, to bring a measure of justice, whether you talk about the right of women to vote, abortion rights, the rights of black and brown people in the United States, no matter which part of the world and which part of history you dig into, militant social movements are a necessary component and a driving force to make progressive change possible. And that's going to be true in this era as well. And what we're seeing throughout the world at this moment is a turning point in global history. It's a genuine and powerful turning point, which if we miss on the left, we do it at our own peril. You know, we're seeing since the Arab Revolution, the Arab Spring in 2011, the Occupy movement in the United States several months later, we're seeing an awakening, a genuine awakening and mood for revolt among especially the younger generations, but among people as a, working people as a whole. And that's manifesting, as you know, in the fact that the Bernie Sanders campaign has energized and electrified tens of millions of Americans like never before. And a lot of people from outside the United States are really, correctly paying attention to it, because this, the United States is the bastion of global capitalism. And in this country, you are seeing the rise of the idea of a political revolution being championed by somebody who is a self-professed democratic socialist. So the socialist word is no longer something that's taboo. You know, the Cold War era is long gone. And just one other thing I'll point out is that, you know, while social movements should be fighting for reforms under capitalism, and I use the word fighting very consciously and deliberately, because any reform that we win is not going to be out of some sort of largesse or out of sense of justice of the billionaire class. Any reform is something that we gain by when we wrest it out of the hands of the ruling class through determined social movements that have strategy and tactics that are organized in such a way that tip the balance of forces towards us and away from corporations who have all the wealth and the political clout. While we should be fighting for those reforms, and those reforms will be hard fought for, we do need to raise the vision of a systemic shift away from capitalism. And the militant labor movements in Europe from the past are a useful guide, because all the movements that won, whether it was housing or the National Health Service or public education funds, those were won not only by labor movements that were willing to fight hard, but they were led by socialists who understood that reforms will not be enough. And I think it's important to reawaken that conversation now.
And right now we're in the middle of an election cycle. And I was wondering if you can speak to the role that housing and homelessness has within the general debates within this presidential cycle.
I think it's extremely important what especially the Bernie Sanders campaign and Bernie himself has done, but also some rare political figures like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez on the national level have done, which is elevate the housing crisis as something to be discussed at the national level when it hasn't actually been done for probably decades. I hear a lot of people who've been involved in American politics, you know, for longer than I have, and who will tell me that actually it's not been something that was discussed at the national level. And it's important that the crisis that individual cities and regions are facing is now being recognized as not only as a nationwide trend during this period, after the Great Recession, but also as something fundamental to capitalism, that, you know, really, the problem with capitalism is that it is incapable of solving the basic questions that face us as a society. You know, if people correctly say housing is a human right, housing should be a human right, but it isn't a human right under capitalism. And that's why it's critical that Bernie Sanders campaign and Ocasio-Cortez herself, they are raising the question that we've been raising as socialist alternative in Seattle, but also in other cities, because we are a nationwide organization. We have our members in cities like Boston, Minneapolis, New York, where similar housing crises are being faced. We also have our members in the Bay Area and Los Angeles area, where the struggles for housing, affordable housing, mirror the ones in Seattle. And the specific demands that are being raised, not only by us in Seattle, but in these other regions and by Bernie campaign, is the need to tax big business to fund a massive expansion of affordable housing that is publicly owned. That is the main aspect of social housing, but also the need for rent control. Rent control is an important reform under capitalism, which if we, you know, and the kind of rent control we're fighting for is a strong citywide rent control with no corporate loopholes, meaning it is rent control that is maintained across tenancies. So when a tenant leaves, the landlord doesn't get to raise the rent to some sort of market rate. And so it goes up only by the inflation rate. This would be an important victory, but it will not be easy to win, obviously, because we will have the entire real estate lobby, the big banks, and Wall Street opposed to us.
So speaking of things that aren't human rights under capitalism, I'd like to pivot now a little bit into healthcare. Obviously, the coronavirus is something that is seriously affecting Washington State at the moment. I know Governor Jay Inslee has declared an emergency. I saw on Democracy Now! You were talking about the fact that, you know, previously emergencies have been called in Seattle for homelessness, etc. And there's almost a sense of emergency fatigue in the sense that people don't believe that establishment politicians are actually trying to do anything about crises like this in terms of actually fixing the healthcare system. I wondered if you could expand on that.
Yes, that's as you said correctly, the Seattle region, especially Kirkland, which is a neighboring city, has become the epicenter for the outbreak of the coronavirus. And as you correctly said, there have been emergencies that have been declared by the Seattle mayor in the past. In fact, as I said on Democracy Now!, there was an emergency declared around homelessness just a few years ago. I was on the city council when that happened, and I supported that. But nothing came out of it, and we had predicted that nothing much would come out of it because, you know, in periods of crisis, corporate politicians and even well-meaning but politicians who don't have the courage to go up against a Democratic elite, you know, unlike Bernie Sanders, who is going up against them, they will issue such proclamations, but it will not have much substance behind it to actually address the crisis. And so that's what's happened. I mean, there was an emergency declared on homelessness, and homelessness has only worsened, I mean, to a dramatic degree since that emergency proclamation was declared. So it didn't really achieve anything. So it's important, actually, what's happening this time around, where I issued a letter on Monday, a public letter to the mayor of Seattle and to the King County executive, saying that the main issue here, as it's being pointed out, is the lack of resources for testing. Because of the anarchic and completely inhumane so-called healthcare system in the United States, which is geared for profits for the insurance and pharma and health management industries, you know, again, it's a billionaire generating industry, and it's the same industry that kills tens of thousands of people simply because they don't have access to healthcare. And so that system is so deeply dysfunctional that not only the many who are uninsured, but even the many who are insured but are deeply underinsured can't have basic testing access because they get thousands of dollars of bills. So people don't go and get themselves tested. And what do you need on day one of a pandemic like this? You need for people to know that they are not carrying the virus and to have treatment and the care that they need if they have a sickness of any kind. And so this has been raised prominently. And so, as I said, I sent, and it's important that we have this socialist council office through my re-election last year, which we won only because our movement fought hard against the complete onslaught of corporate money and corporate lies. So you can see the importance of having such an office for the working class, because we are able to completely shift the political debate away from establishment talking points, you know, where all the right, you know, compassion, let's have compassion, let's use hand sanitizer, you know, it's all limited to that, rather than saying, what do we actually need to do based on the scientific advice of epidemiologists, which is make sure that testing and treatment is provided immediately. And so it's really important that we have won this victory where the governor, you know, several hours after the Democracy Now! Interview, said that he's going to allow testing free. And also there was another executive order which would allow underinsured people who have insurance but not very good insurance to have free prescription refills. That is all very crucial. I think, though, this also, the coronavirus crisis in the United States is such a, it's unfortunate that this is coming about this way, but it is such an important example of the need for Medicare for all and the complete anarchy and incompetence of a private healthcare system compared to the real functionality and rationality behind a Medicare for all system. And one really stark example of that concretely is, you know, compare United States and South Korea. Both countries, I think, identified the virus on the same day or the same period, roughly. And look at the progress South Korea has made because they have a one form of medical public healthcare system. They've been able to completely surpass the United States' ability to provide testing because of that public program, rather than the richest country in the world, you know, where we are lagging behind. And as of yesterday, only 500 cases were being tested nationwide. I mean, this is disastrous. So this needs to change. And it's important that in Washington, the political establishment is under pressure to do things right. But can I just bring up one more issue related to the coronavirus? It's not exactly healthcare related, but it is related. One of the key parts of containing the spread of this virus is for people to stay home if they can. But it's not good enough for public health officials to say, stay home if you can. How are the hundreds of thousands of service workers in this region, the delivery drivers, the Amazon warehouse workers and cargo handlers, the custodial workers, all those workers who are not tech workers and who can't just work from home, what are they going to do for paid leave? So the labor movement has fought for and won paid sick leave in Seattle and Washington State, but it is not enough. It is going to be necessary for us in the coming days to really fight for paid sick leave for all workers who are capable of going into quarantine so that we can contain the virus.
And one thing that you said in your interview is that you said that Joe Biden represents the same status quo that will not allow us to have this because the billionaire class is absolutely opposed to it. I was wondering if you'd give your assessment on the distinctions between Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders on healthcare and how you would see them in as reacting to this coronavirus outbreak that we're seeing right now.
Obviously, now about a specific distinction between Bernie Sanders and Joe Biden, but I think we have to recognize that it's not an unusual thing for Joe Biden to be who he is, which is, you know, somebody who has had over four decades in service of Wall Street interests. That's the definition of most of the Democratic Party politicians. What stands out is that Bernie Sanders is different, and he is one of the rare political figures inside the Democratic Party who is not only bringing forward the question of Medicare for all, but has doggedly been pushing for that and has been unwavering on that for all of his public service. So if you compare 35 years of Bernie Sanders' public record to Joe Biden's, there are such stark differences. Bernie and what makes Bernie Sanders' campaign an important vehicle for to make progress on Medicare for all is that his campaign, as I said before, has brought together millions and maybe tens of millions of people, at least, you know, paying attention, but millions actively energized around his campaign, specifically on this question. And it is such a, you know how the establishment talks about, well, we need a unity candidate. Well, you've never seen a unity candidate like Bernie Sanders in the last many years, because he is uniting people from different states, from different backgrounds, from different ethnic and racial and gender backgrounds around Medicare for all, because it is a universal misery that people go through. Even if you're insured, you are in crisis, let alone if you're uninsured. And what is really important is that the key states that are swing states, meaning the Democratic candidate could take them or Trump could take them, in those key swing states, Medicare for all question looms large in that whole discussion.
So obviously I'm calling you here from London, where we've had healthcare that is free at the point of use with the NHS for over 70 years now. We also, in this country, have a two-tiered system where the wealthier members of society, or those with professional jobs, can secure themselves private healthcare if they can afford it or if their job provides it. I wondered if you could, as a democratic socialist, explain why you believe that universality is key when it comes to healthcare and why you prefer a single-payer system over a two-tiered system like we have here in the United Kingdom.
So just to give you sort of an analogous example, let me start with an example of wages. So what you see is that when you have higher wages that have been mandated, it actually drives up the wages of all workers at every level, forward. And if you don't have that citywide or region-wide policy or statewide or nationwide policy, it actually acts as a race to the bottom. And what happens with healthcare, if you don't have a single payer system like the one Bernie Sanders is fighting for and the one that Socialist Alternative and I support, is you have a situation like in the United Kingdom where you have the National Health Service, yes, but when the wealthy have the option of using a private services, it creates a situation where the wealthy are not only are not invested in maintaining and augmenting the public health service, but they have a continued incentive to keep attacking the National Health Service, keep gutting it of services. And basically what you will end up having if you let that process continue to its logical conclusion is have either a completely hollowed out system, healthcare system that doesn't work at all, but it's there in name, or it could get dismantled. I'm just saying that in the absence of social movements fighting to maintain it and expand it, you will see that kind of situation. And you're already seeing that. I mean, we hear so many examples in the news, from here in the US, of how there are so many people suffering, even though there is a public healthcare system in the UK, but because it's not a single payer system, because many public services, not just healthcare, but others, council housing, have been attacked over the last few decades and are a severely reduced form of what the labor movements fought for in the past. And that's why it's critical that we have a single payer system. And specifically this you can already see in the United States, the prices for very basic medications are so prohibitively high that if we don't go to a single payer system, it will, and if we stop at something that is halfway there, it will still continue to be dysfunctional, continue to cause the kinds of deaths, maybe in slightly reduced numbers, but the kinds of unnecessary deaths that happen every year because people don't have access to basic things. And I'll tell you another thing, it's as a matter of strategy, and I was referring to this earlier, when we fight for a service, and we should insist on this, when we fight for a service that is free for everybody, that's when it eliminates the space for the wealthy to straightforwardly attack it. I mean, and I say it that way because as long as capitalism remains intact, even if we want single payer, they will continue to attack it. Yes, but it will be harder for them to attack and dismantle it. And I'll give you a concrete example. The Medicare program for elderly people in the US, the Social Security program, these programs, when they were won, there were big business people who were saying we should make it only for poor people, not for rich people, because, and they make this, it's a specious argument. On the face of it, it sounds reasonable, but it's actually a dangerous argument when they say, well, why do we need Social Security for rich people? The problem is if you don't make it that way, then they will have an easier time attacking it. And the reason Social Security still stands today, the reason Medicaid and Medicare still stand today is, despite 40 years of attacks, is because they actually are available for everybody and creates a fundamental unity to keep it alive. And that's why it's really important, last point, sorry, that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez clearly pointed out that she rejected Pete Buttigieg, when he was running for the Democratic nomination. He continually attacked Sanders' policy for public education for all by saying, well, why do rich people need it? Again, you know, you see that specious argument coming up again and again. And she said, well, you know why we want it for everybody? It's because the same rich people will attack the program if you keep it only for poor and working class people.
Thank you for listening to this Our Voices podcast from Open Democracy. If you enjoyed this podcast and would encourage others to listen, head to iTunes, subscribe, and leave us a review. Open Democracy is an independent global media platform that is only possible because of your kind donations. To find out more or to make a donation, head to opendemocracy.net.